going to wait because I think there's still quite a few people outside that are heading in. But if you're here for the RAA licensing provision workshop, you're in the right room. Otherwise, this plane is headed to Miami. So make sure you're going to the right place. Thank you. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I think we'll get started. My name is Tim Cole. I'm ICANN staff, and Pam Little is here with me too, also as ICANN staff. We're going to give some preliminary background information, but the panel is made up of community members, and we really want the dialogue to be among community members. So we don't intend to speak a lot, other than I will try to moderate to the extent that's going to be possible. And I wanted to also mention that Marika here is going to be moderating the or monitoring the remote participation. So if you're listening remotely, you can type in the chat room if you have questions that you want to ask or any comments you want to add, and she will represent your interests in that regard. We also have one of our panelists is participating remotely. Fabricio, are you on the call?
I am, Tim. Hello.
Great. So I will be introducing the panel shortly and going over. Come on. Okay. Let's see if we can make this. Slide doesn't want to go. Oh, wait. So the agenda for our workshop today is I've asked Pam Little just to say a few words at the beginning just to talk about what the ICANN compliance department's experience in enforcing the licensing provision of the RAA has been. Then we will move to the panelists, and each of them I've asked to spend about 5 minutes with preliminary remarks about their thoughts concerning what the provision should accomplish, and if appropriate, what is the problem they think it does or wish it would address. So each one will speak to that for 5 minutes, and then or less, and then we will come back and go around and talk about any suggested changes or proposals or thoughts about what should happen next. One piece of background that I wanted to give before we start down that path is that this workshop grew out of the responses that we received, that ICANN received, to a draft advisory that was prepared and posted for public comment last summer. The advisory, which had been intended to clarify the meanings of certain terms in this one section of the Registrar Accreditation Agreement, touched a nerve among some ICANN community members. And the reactions to the proposed clarifications that were in the document ranged from full support to concern that the proposals exceeded what was appropriate for staff to publish. Today, we hope to explore those reactions and seek ideas for possible next steps going forward. So, again, as I said, this is intended to be a community dialogue, not an ICANN dialogue or ICANN staff dialogue. So we're here to moderate and to listen and to hear from the various folks on the panel. And then, of course, we will also have an open Q&A session. Now, just to tell you who our panelists are, we have... Oh, come on. Slow down. I've already mentioned Pam, who is the senior director of our contractual compliance department. Elliot Noss from Two Cows. Andrew Combs from IACC. Wendy Seltzer from the NCSG. Mason Cole from Oversee.net, also chair of the registrar constituency. Fabricio Vieira from Time Warner is on the phone, participating remotely. And Bo Brendler at the far end of the table here is from ALAC. So with that, I'm just going to ask Pam to make some brief comments about the experience of our compliance department.
Thank you, Tim. Hi, everyone. We look back at the data and records we have within contractual compliance over the last 3 years just to see what sort of matters that are being brought to ICANN contractual compliance attention in terms of enforcing this provision or problems that users experienced in enforcing this provision. Our records seem to indicate they were only very few matters brought to our attention. In fact, over the 3 years period that I have data available to me, there were less than 10 matters that brought to contractual compliance attention. And these were mainly from attorneys, apart from one of them was actually from a brand owner and another one from a registrar when they encountered some difficulties in enforcing this provision. And as many of you probably would know, this is a mandatory provision to be included in the registration agreement between registrar and registrants. So as far as ICANN contractual compliance is concerned, if that provision isn't included in the registrar's registration agreement with their customers, i.e. registrants, then that would be potentially a breach of the RAA. And that's, to me, the element that ICANN can actually enforce. Otherwise, because this is a provision in the registration agreement between registrar and registrant, and then involving third party trying to enforce the provision in that agreement, it is really not much that ICANN contractual compliance can force the registrar to enforce that provision against their registrant, their customers. So this is basically what we see from contractual compliance, apart from enforceability of this provision, to see whether it's effective. So in summary, there are two issues that I see. One is enforceability. The other one we see sometimes involve who is problem or issue, because apart from this difficulty for third party to enforce this provision, sometimes we also found some of those registrations using proxy or privacy services seem to also not comply with the WHOIS requirement to have the technical and admin information, which is required under 3773. Obviously, the registrant's information is going to be the proxy or service provider's information, but you still need to provide the technical and admin information. But sometimes these type of registrations seem to have sort of, you know, not as complete or accurate information. And that's the two areas we found from a compliance perspective: enforceability difficulties and the WHOIS information issue. That's all I have observed so far. Tim?
Thank you, Pam. So with that, we can now move on to the panelists. I just thought that would be good to have some background to refer to as we go forward. And I'm going to ask, we're going to just work our way down the table here, so I'm going to ask Elliot to start off and take about 5 minutes or so, if you could.
Thanks, Tim. So this, as staff knows, is an advisory that I've been very upset about from the moment it was launched. And my complaints really come from two directions. The first is process. I feel that this was a process, the original publishing of the advisory was at the behest of a single group, and most importantly, was done without any consultation, admittedly, without any consultation from those who actually provide who is privacy services. Staff has been great in being responsive to those laments of mine. The second is a contractual matter. The RAA clearly states there is no third-party liability. There are no third-party beneficiaries to the contract. That is the more important feature or fact that we're dealing with today. ICANN itself has always respected that element of the contract. What I wanted to do is to provide you all with some facts, because to this point, this process has sadly been a fact-free zone. Tucows, which represents in the high single digits to 10% of the namespace, receives about one complaint about who is privacy a day. That's quite a high volume. Virtually every single one of those is from a lawyer by post. Virtually every single one of those is an intellectual property, not a legal issue. And when I say not a legal, not a criminal issue. We're not in the civil liability business. Every single one of those comes with a threat. Comes with threats towards us, to sometimes my parents and children. They're quite broad. Anybody who's in the registrar space knows that the tone and type of these letters are not intended to accomplish a small task, but are last generation legal practice of threats and casting the net as widely as possible. We always respond politely. We never respond in kind. We always educate the lawyer about the way the process and the system works. We always forward that complaint on to the registrant. We always include, as the bulk of our practice is a wholesale business, we always notify the reseller that this request has been made, because they are, in almost every case, closer to the end customer. And we always allow provision and room for follow-up. In virtually no cases, so in the 1% to less range, does the lawyer with an intellectual property issue follow up with us. And there's two more points I want to make at a factual level. First, I'd like to take law enforcement out of this discussion, not because they're not important to it, but because they are dealt with separately and differently, and in without exception, effectively. There are very, very few legal requests to go underneath who is privacy. They are always dealt with expeditiously and in a different way. And it's also worth noting that at a compliance level, even intellectual property issues, such as phishing, that have an immediate need, are dealt with effectively by Tucows, and in my view, by all or the vast majority, no, I shouldn't say all at all, the vast majority of registrars, in out-of-band processes where there have been relationships developed over the years between the compliance department of major registrars and the compliance department of intellectual property holders who are regularly on the wrong end of these issues. This may be dealing with an inconvenience for some lawyers in some civil matters. I won't bore you with the inconveniences we face as it relates to this that we don't complain about. But what I will tell you is nobody has shared with us, and I look forward to the rest of the panel doing so, what specific harms, other than inconvenience, we're trying to deal with here. And lastly, if there are legitimate issues that are not dealt with in the current processes, the right way to deal with those is together, not to bust up a very, very important principle, no third-party beneficiaries to the contract, that will open the door to a vast range of frivolous and vexatious litigation. Thank you.
Thank you, Elliot. Perhaps I failed to mention, but Elliot is Two Cows is a registrar. Andy Coombs is next, and he's coming from the intellectual property constituency. I thought this would be a good sequence to go on. So,
I actually would have preferred to go after Andy, but that's okay.
Well,
we're both Canadian, so it's okay.
I would have agreed with that, too. As one of the lawyers who writes those pernicious cease and desist letters, I don't think you're talking about any of mine being a polite Canadian.
I'll search when I'm back.
A moment. I am not as familiar to this group, and so I want to sort of explain a little background and why this is an issue for us and why the advisory is something that we keenly supported, but we're obviously open to other approaches to dealing with the issues that we attempted to address through the advisory. I practice in the area of intellectual property enforcement. I write those cease and desist letters. I would rather not write them to you. I represent an entity here called the International Anti-Counterfeiting Coalition, and I'm sorry if I just realized the microphone's over here. And that organization includes a number of rights owners that are concerned with the protection of their intellectual property rights online. These companies include major brands like Nike and Louis Vuitton, major studios like Warner Brothers and Disney, and they are confronted with massive abuse of their intellectual property rights online. And that, in this context, in the context of the IACC, is reflected largely in terms of the sale of counterfeit and pirated merchandise. But it's not limited to that. It includes other forms of malicious conduct, and I appreciate the fact, Elliot, that you acknowledge that phishing, for example, is a type of malicious conduct that implicates some of those same intellectual property rights that we're trying to address privately. So I'm not sure I agree with the characterization of this being solely a private inconvenience, because in many cases, the victims of this activity are not only the rights owners, they're the internet community at large, and there are many of the people in this room who share a concern in mitigating malicious conduct online. Let me say, you know, as an internet user, I'm fine with privacy services. I have no issue with it. And as an IP rights representative, I recognize that privacy services are probably now a permanent part of the DNS ecosystem. So why is this particular provision important for us, and why do we think that some form of clarification or guidance is required? Well, first, there have been some ICANN studies that show that privacy services account for approximately 20% of the registrations in the domain name space. And there's additional studies that have been published by ICANN which indicate that between about one quarter and one third of those privately registered domain names are engaged in malicious conduct. And that same study showed that all of that was in the commercial sphere. So we're talking about 5-7% of the domain name space using proxy services that are engaged in malicious conduct. And why we're interested in that is because a significant part of it does involve the infraction of intellectual property rights. Not only, and there are other types of investigative issues, and Elliot, again, you've acknowledged that law enforcement has issues which may go beyond or are not entirely in sync with the interests of IP rights owners, but there is an overlap because many IP rights violations are also criminal violations. The benefit of access to the information that 3.7.7.3 addresses is that it enables not only that investigation to occur by private rights owners, but for sort of initial attempts at resolution. And the initial private resolution of these disputes, frankly, is in everyone's interest. It's in the interest of the rights owner, who can secure more cost-effective enforcement through those pernicious cease and desist letters. It's in the interest of the infringer, who's ultimately going to be held to account. And if they can be held to account pursuant to an informal demand process at lower cost, it's going to expedite resolution. It's going to expedite resolution on a cheaper basis. And that may be part of the inconvenience you're referring to, but it's not the only thing, because some of this is criminal conduct. Some of this goes beyond the ability to for private resolution. And then you're talking about the invocation of private resources. Public resources. So the tax monies are being used for criminal or administrative enforcement, where if access to the information were available as contemplated by this provision, a private resolution might have occurred without that being necessary. So the issues that I think we're primarily concerned with is obtaining timely access to the information and information upon demonstration of actual harm without the necessity of bringing the formal legal proceeding, which some privacy services do require. And I think I will agree with you that probably the vast majority of proxy services do have procedures in place, although there's some variation in those procedures, but they do have procedures in place by which that information will be disclosed to the rights owners. But there are some that don't, and frankly, that's where a significant part of the problem lies, and why some form of advisory or some other mechanism should be used to address the issue. Now, to respond to two sort of specific points, without getting into cease and desist letters, one is well, let me come back to that. The I think that actually pretty much covers it. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you. I'm right behind you.
Thanks, Andy. Wendy Seltzer has another point of view, and so you're up.
Thank you, Tim. So I'm Wendy Seltzer, yet another attorney on the panel here. I'm here as the founder of the Chilling Effects Clearinghouse, a website and research project, collaboration among law school clinics at Harvard and Berkeley and Stanford and elsewhere, that studies cease and desist letters and their impact on online speech. And I'm here as a privacy advocate and a member of the non-commercial stakeholders group concerned about the privacy of registrants and even their opportunities to communicate anonymously without being identified in their communications. I'm not speaking here for NCSG. And I want to return to some of the points that Elliot raised first about the contractual nature of the provision that we're talking about. Because one of the features of a system of private self-ordering, which is what ICANN is that it rests upon underlying law and can't substitute for that underlying law. So the underlying law here is the law of contract and intellectual property and criminal liability, and that has important limitations. For example, that contracts can bind the parties to the contract and creates rights between those parties, but when there's a clear clause in the contract that says there are no third-party beneficiaries to those contracts, it doesn't create rights that spring to third parties. So this clause and the advisory explaining it assert that the registered name holder who licenses use shall accept liability for harm caused by wrongful use of the registered name. That's something that ICANN simply doesn't have the power to assign as against third parties here. It's not something that ICANN can do as a matter of contract law because that liability is a matter of external law. Perhaps the external law creates a secondary or intermediary liability for someone who knowingly facilitates wrongful conduct, but perhaps it creates no such liability. Perhaps it immunizes the online service provider from liability for acts of its users, as other provisions of the United States law do. So Communications Decency Act, CDA Section 230, says that online service providers are not liable for most of the content posted by end users, period. It has exceptions for intellectual property and for criminal law, which each have different provisions. Again, under U.S. law, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act sets up safe harbors from liability for Internet service providers who respond expeditiously to claims of infringement. Again, a different set of procedures from what's specified here. And none of those procedures say anything about revealing the name of the user who's claimed to be infringing. Where it's important to a user to communicate without revealing a name, perhaps because the user fears retaliation, perhaps because the user fears extra legal response if he's identified. It's important to protect a lawful speaker's right to speak without having an identity revealed. The underlying law has due process considerations that before somebody is held liable, they be given an opportunity to hear the charges against them and contest those. And before someone is subject to legal detriment, if someone has chosen to keep his identifying information private, revealing that information to third parties is a legal detriment for which due process to the end user, to the user of the name, not just an assessment by a service provider that there might be evidence of actionable harm. And that's not a burden we should be putting on the service provider, on the registrar or the provider of a proxy or privacy service. Because if those services become too expensive because of too many compliance questions, or if we demand that they undertake expensive investigations upon receiving each of these dozens of cease and desist letters, those services will then be priced out of affordability for individuals who are trying to avail themselves of means of speaking without publishing all of their personal information online. So I think that this procedure imposes or tries to impose a species of secondary liability that's beyond ICANN's power to impose through contracts here, dangerous to the speech environment and the opportunities for online speech that the Internet provides, and not something that's appropriate to elaborate in an advisory coming out of nowhere.
Thank you, Wendy. Now I'm going to move on down to Mason Cole, who is with Oversee.net and is a registrar representative on this panel.
Thank you, Tim. I first of all, I'd just like to say thank you for including registrars in this panel. I hope this is a valuable discussion. I don't have much of a prepared statement about the provision, but I do want to talk a bit about the interaction of the community on issues relating to registrars, because it applies here as well. I agree with much of what everyone on the panel here has said so far. I have been concerned since assuming the chair about a year and a half ago that with so many things happening in internet governance and so many concerns being applied to domain names as internet usage continues to grow, that the easiest way at times to deal with those problems is to try to find a way to remove or to take action on the domain name itself. For example, if someone has a domain name registered in the U.S. but lives in Russia, or you know another country where it's difficult for law enforcement to coordinate, it's very difficult for law enforcement to reach or the legal system to reach the bad actor. It's very easy in comparison to take action on a domain name. So so registrars or registries have become the path of least resistance, if you will, in terms of taking action on bad behavior. So that's created from the registrar's point of view. At times, that creates a surge of activity aimed at our businesses, not necessarily in a malicious way toward us or our companies, but it ends up, as has been pointed out, placing quite a bit of financial and operational burden on us, and at times on our customers. So due to that concern, which I think is pretty widely shared by registrars, something that the registrars have been doing is making an effort, quite a concerted effort, to talk with others in the community. We've done so very productively with law enforcement. I know Bobby Flame is here from the FBI, and he and I have spent the last 6 months coordinating very productive discussions between law enforcement and registrars. With the idea that if we can learn and understand more about one another's positions and the problems that we're dealing with, we can probably find much more effective ways of dealing with those problems rather than resorting to policy development or proposed changes to the RAA. And that's been very useful. Registrars have started this process with the intellectual property community as well, and I hope that continues to bear fruit. With regard to the RAA, as you know, there's an effort now to amend the RAA. There have been more than 150 provisions suggested for the RAA. And I know we're in discussion with the community about that. The registrars are clearly willing to work with those in the community who have concerns about actions taken by us or our customers. However, I have to say I share Elliot's concern that if there's going to be legislation, if you will, funneled through the RAA, then that becomes problematic for us. You know, I know that commercial interests on the internet aren't always universally admired, but they exist, and we have responsibilities to ourselves and our customers, and we do need predictability on what to do with our agreements. And so if there needs to be a conversation about difficulties with privacy and proxy services, that's fine. Changing the RAA may or may not be the answer to that problem. I would prefer a productive conversation about what the realities are about problems and then find mutually useful ways to solve them. And I hope that's what we can get to here. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks, Mason. Now we're going to go to the invisible person between Mason and Bo. Fabricio, is representing, also comes from the intellectual property constituency, and is with Time Warner Inc. And it's your turn at the mic here, Fabricio. Welcome.
Thank you, Tim. Can you guys hear me okay?
Just great.
Great. Well, first I just want to thank you guys for allowing me to still be on this panel remotely. I very much value being able to be on this panel and work with the folks there. I do have to apologize for not being able to be there with you guys and both the folks on the panel and those in the audience. So please do accept my apology for that. I'm very fortunate to come after Elliot, Andy, Wendy, and Mason. As Mason started out to say, he agrees with what most people on the panel have said, and I can actually say the same thing. I heard a lot of the same keywords, buzz phrases that I was planning on using, and luckily Andy pretty much established everything I would have said from an IP perspective, right down to the fact that I also am a letter sender, but you know would prefer not to be the one who does that. So Tim, at the outset, you had asked us to be prepared to speak about what we think the provision could accomplish. because of what's already been said, I can make my statement pretty brief. Three words: uniformity, reliability, and enforceability. And I think that that doesn't just go for the IP community, which I'm closest to, but I think it goes to, you know, Elliot and Mason's group. It goes right to those who Wendy represents. We really need to get down to those three things: uniformity, reliability, enforceability. So, you know, when it comes to what do I think the problem, you know, that would be addressed here, you know, plainly speaking, without having uniformity, reliability, and enforceability, what we end up with is unnecessary friction between parties that don't need to be fighting. In this case, and I think we may hear more about it later, but, you know, say that the IP community and registrars, by way of example, don't need to be pitted against each other, not on this, and probably not on a lot of things. So, you know, I think that establishing a uniformity, reliability, enforceability does away with that unnecessary friction and allows, you know, the fight, and I use that word loosely, allows the fight to be where it needs to be. In the case of malicious conduct, in the case of infringement, et cetera, it allows the fight to be between, say, the IP owner or law enforcement with those perpetrating the harms, and allows those who don't need to be in the fight to step out of it. You know, I want to give a good example because I was listening to Elliot speak, and again, I think he used a lot of the buzzwords that I was thinking about going through as well. And I have a great example to use actually with Elliot's registrar, and a really great example. You know, he mentioned that there was a process without consultation, and that you know, there's a mention about cooperation in there, and I think Mason mentioned the same thing. I've had great experience with Elliot's registrar in that regard, in that I have one from a vanilla infringement standpoint that happened most recently that I think is a good example, but a better example is one where we had a phishing example, and if you guys could bear with me for a second, I think it would be illustrative of what we're talking about here going forward. I was at the time in private practice representing an internet company, and we ended up having a phishing site which replicated their entire login page. And unfortunately, an elderly man ended up being deployed to that and gave his information. They wiped out his bank account, et cetera. We had to send one of those nasty letters, finding the who is, to this man, not knowing that he had been defrauded. When I got a hold of him, he let us know what had happened, and obviously was very hesitant about signing anything for us to transfer the name or to get it out of his name, because he didn't know if we were in furtherance of the fraud. Unfortunately, through cooperation, we were able to call Elliot's registrar, Two Cows, work with their then compliance officer, Paul Karkas, and say, listen, this guy's been defrauded. Here's, you know, reasonable actionable harm, et cetera. He's unfortunately the registrant and has been duped that way. His card was used and his information was used to defraud others. Let's try to get him off the registration and do away with this domain name. And through cooperation, we were able to do that. My fear is that today the trend with kind of the proxy privacy stuff, what we end up with is an inability to cooperate. I would not be able to actually call Two Cows, Elliot or Paul, and say, hey guys, this is what we found out. We literally are stuck. We don't know from day one who to even contact. And so what we're left with is an escalation of, say, litigation. So to Wendy's point, I want the right person to have due process. And my fear is that when we don't have cooperation, we don't have ability to uncover what's going on and actually have that conversation, to Andy's point, it's not just a situation where the IP owner has increased costs and inconvenience. In that instance, for example, it would be this poor person who's been defrauded once is now getting hit with a lawsuit, and he doesn't have the money, he doesn't have the resources to then go in and hire an attorney to try to get him out of that. And so I think that illustrates a situation where having who is, even though it was false, helped everybody, those who would have been defrauded going forward, those who had already been defrauded, and those who were trying to stop the fraud. You know, it actually put the fight where it needed to be, so to speak, and reduced costs for everyone and helped everybody. So, you know, I think that sums up what I'm looking to do. And frankly, I do agree with everyone here, which is that there needs to be a discussion and more cooperation to get at what the real problem is and figure out some good solutions to it. And that's it for me.
Thank you, Fabrizio. And last but certainly not least, Bo Brendler, who's comes to us as a member of ALAC, and he has had the least amount of time to prepare for this, so I don't want to be putting him on the spot too much because he just learned that he was going to be on this panel a few hours ago. But, Bo, I'm sure you'll have some good views to share with us. Thanks.
Thank you, and thank you for having us here. As everyone knows, the at-large is mandated to represent the user community, beyond registrants, I am speaking for the at-large. I wanted to read you a couple of examples of some of the communications we get from regular people out there regards this issue, and then I'll come back to the actual statement that the at-large made about 3.7.7.3 that I wrote, but it's very brief. So this is a note from, or a complaint from a consumer. DiscountDomainRegistry.com is one of the worst domain registry resellers I've ever seen. They are a reseller for two cows, which isn't any better. Be warned, if your reseller fails, website is down, or goes out of business, you will only be able to email compliance for help. This took me 2 hours to find the information and track it down. After that, it took almost 4 hours for them to respond to my email. No contact information for two cows is given. They will not help you no matter what with any direct or phone support. Certainly we take, complaints from consumers or the general public with a grain of salt or with some, you know, measure of distance. But I have another example here. Just bear with me while I pull it up. Enom and Parallels have left us absolutely astounded at how incompetent, slow, and worthless they've been during the past week. I'm Canadian, so I'm trying to be polite. One of our domain names expired, and upon renewal attempt was nowhere to be found. Within our Enom reseller account, one of which was originally provisioned through Modern Bill, we got in touch with Enom support. Within 3 to 4 hours, Enom responded and stated that because of our relationship with Parallels as a sub-reseller, we'd have to contact them. Under 24 hours later, Enom responded with a general no-can help. Okay. I think I have one other example here that's indicative of so Internet X reseller problem turned on domain registrants. Reseller of domain name registrar Internet X didn't pay for its customers' registrations, and now the registrar is asking domain registrants to foot the bill. The company sent an email to customers of one of its resellers that demanded payment for domains the customers already paid for or faced their deletion. So I think that the issue of some registrars using resellers to either circumvent the RAA or to, you know, do to sort of put an arm's length between them and actually doing proper customer service is an issue that goes all the way back to RegisterFly. I just want to find one other example here. Now, when the at-large looked at 3.7.3, we interpreted it perhaps somewhat differently. We didn't go into issues of who is, but I was also noticing that the organization Spam House, which is very well respected, also interpreted this in the same way. 3.7.7.3 assigns the responsibility of anonymizing registrars or resellers over abuses committed in their name, as it is their name on the registration. So, with that in mind, the statement that I wrote very briefly for the at-large was that the at-large supports the text and the intent of RIA Section 3.7.7.3, the effect of which creates accountability and transparency with regard to registered name holders. Specifically, RIA Section 3.7.7.3 contains provisions to increase accountability and transparency in name registration abuse. Therefore, the ALAC strongly supports the proposed advisory notice, and that was voted unanimously 14 to 0 in approval. So one might say from that that the user community is unanimously behind 3.7.7.3 as it's as I've described the way that we interpreted it.
Thank you, Bo. I'm not quite sure where the reseller. The 3.7.7.3 does not mention resellers, maybe you could clarify how those examples fit the 3.7.7.3.
The way we interpreted it, and some of the advice we got was that the language that talks about registered name holders intending to license use of a domain name to a third party is nonetheless the registered name holder. We interpreted that to mean if a registrar uses a third party to sell domain names, ultimately the registrar that owns the reseller is responsible for that which might occur in regards to that name, including issues of customer service.
Okay, I'm going to let Elias speak now.
Bo. First of all, you've completely missed the issue. This has nothing to do with resellers. Second of all, when you use examples where you haven't chosen to speak to the registrars involved, but instead just put them out, you just completely discredit yourself. So let's just put this part of it, because it's distractive, aside.
May I respond to that?
I don't think I want to extend to you the courtesy you didn't extend to me. May I take this in a different direction, Tim?
I do think I need to give Bo an opportunity to respond.
What I can simply say is the at-large was given this language and had some turned to some people within ICANN staff for advice on what it might mean. We tried to engage the registrar community in the last ICANN meeting as to what exactly the point of 3.7.7.3 was. And based on our interpretation of it, that's the answer I'm giving. I mean, that's what we thought it was. So if there's a problem with that, I'm certainly willing to take responsibility for it. But that is how the nature of this was translated to us, and hence the statement that we made that I read out was made weeks ago or months ago, or a couple months ago. So. If we were off track, I mean, it would have been great to have that conversation then instead of now.
Okay. Now, as I spelled out the agenda earlier, we've now had everyone make their preliminary statement and talk a little bit about their view of either what this provision is about or what it should do or what ideally people want to see from it or see or not see it at all. Now I think I'd like to do is return to the panelists first, and then we'll open up for questions in a couple minutes. But first I want to have the panelists give us some of your thoughts about next steps. What should we be doing next about this, if anything? And I'm going to go in the same order, but I'm also going to ask you to limit your comments to less than to only about 2 minutes or so, not real lengthy, because we do want to give everyone a chance to participate here.
So I want to be very brief. I do want to call out, the bulk of Andrew's statements were great, but he repeated a piece of data that's just wrong. The ICANN Whois study did not say that a quarter to a third of all Whois privacy users were engaged in malicious conduct. It simply did not, and we can take that offline. The creators of the study agree it didn't say that. I do want to go to Fabrizio's example and use it as a platform for how we can move this process forward. I think Fabrizio, the example is a great one. I appreciate you telling that story. And in the way that Whois privacy is dealt with, in my understanding of it, by most registrars, your example would still, in exactly the same way, with you reaching out to me, you reaching out to Paul, any lawyer, it doesn't have to be you, somebody who you know I know and work with in the process, reaching out through our compliance department with a matter of urgency like that, it's treated appropriately. And if instead that reach out is a straight communication and not a long series of threats, it's reacted to so appropriately, whether there would be who is privacy or not. And I think that sets up, you use that, I think it was process uniformity and reliability. I think that's great. You know, the shame is that what we're in here doing today is talking about a provision in the contract and the output of which would be to take the privity in the contract and change it to create third-party liability for registrars. And instead what we're not doing is, you know, Andrew and I in a small group are in another room trying to create perhaps best practices for who is privacy or trying to solve very real problems. You know, the things that get done constructively in this community get done by small groups of people who want the same thing working together. And again, instead of doing a panel like this and talking about this in the context of a contract that has real unintended consequences in the approach that's taken, we should just be working on this. You know, at Two Cows we have a saying, we like to keep the contracts in the bottom drawer, not the top drawer. And I'd really encourage, you know, all of the folks. I mean, Fabrizio, you and I have had some, I think, great productive examples. Andrew, we've just met. Hey, let's go do it. Right? So that's the way that things should get done here. And I'd really, really appreciate it if everybody involved, especially on the IP side, would take that to heart if what their intention is to really solve these issues. Thank you.
I think there are a couple of different levels of issues here which are only partly addressed by what you propose, Elliot. First is, I think, as you said, it may be true, and I think it is probably true, that the vast majority of registrars privacy services are broadly compliant in the sense that they provide information on a timely basis and allow people to privately address the disputes that are the subject of the initial communication. Problem is not all. Mm-hmm. And so there needs to be some binding mechanism, whether it's contract or otherwise, that ensures that the compliant ones aren't actually at a competitive disadvantage.
Work together to find
that. So that's one part. The second part is that even as to those services that are compliant, I think, and this goes to Fabrizio's comments, that there's a wide disparity in the way that compliance occurs. And I think the entire community, frankly, benefits. It's easy for Fabrizio, who you know and have worked with, to pick up the phone and call people, some of whose names I've heard for the first time in this call. And I'm an attorney who works in this area. But for the broader internet community, there isn't a sort of systematic way of approaching this problem that makes sense. And a sort of a simplified, preferably uniform approach to allowing that communication works. Now, whether it's done through the contract or not is probably something that is appropriate for discussion. I'm glad that Steve and some others who have a lot more experience with the ICANN processes here are in the room, because they may be able to contribute some thoughts in that respect. I'm a lawyer. I'm used to contracts. That's a good way to have some binding mechanisms. I've heard the comments about the privity issues and so forth. I don't think the advisory changes that. I think what it's trying to do is to provide some guidance to those people who have that as part of their contract, because ICANN told them that it was supposed to be part of the contract, so that it would hopefully drive some degree of conformity and compliance. I don't think that the advisory alone creates a legal obligation by itself. Perhaps based on what we're hearing here, what we should be focusing on is a way to have some expedited process. Now, I understand that the advisory mechanism has been used in the past. Maybe it's not the best one to use here. I'm all ears and open to sort of alternatives.
Thanks, and I too want to pick up on what some of the other speakers said. In particular, Fabrizio's comment that you'd rather leave the fight where it should be between the complainant and the domain name user, I think is precisely where I come down, that we want to facilitate getting the communications to flow there and not through the and not to get stuck at the intermediaries. But I think we can do that by improving the mechanisms for passing through complaints. And I'm sorry that our earlier attempts to do that in some of the WHOIS policy discussions, to put in points of contact and to formalize the mechanisms by which the registrar or the proxy service would pass through a complaint to the end user without simultaneously revealing the name of the end user, because I think that that could facilitate communications without unmasking a user who might still need privacy. And so it's still my hope that we can get to that point through discussions like this one and discussions among the community. Perhaps there's room for development of best practices, development, clear publication of the address at which complaints will be accepted to pass along to end users. And I think that that can be done without moving to the second step of also immediately unmasking a user who has specifically requested privacy. But I think... we have a good basis for continuing those discussions without this advisory.
Just one interruption here. I realize that I have introduced the panel, and everyone who's in the room here can see who is speaking, but I would ask each one, and also when others speak up later, to please identify yourself before you start talking so that the people that are listening remotely will know who they're hearing. Thanks.
Well, to your question, Tim, in
yes, Mason Cole, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Jeez. Boy, how dense am I on that one? This is Mason Cole, I think. So to your question, Tim, about what do we do next? I would like to do two things specifically. One is I'd like to improve the tone, because from the registrar's point of view, we have seen lots and lots and lots and lots of requests from the community to amend contracts and impose policy. Over 150 potential amendments to the RAA without anyone approaching us and saying, hey, you know what, we're having a problem. Do you think you can help us solve it? I would have preferred that step first. I think you'll find that we're actually a very cooperative lot if you give us an opportunity. So when you do have a problem, please knock on our door, and we'll answer it, and we'll have an intelligent discussion with you. In terms of 3773, I think we should ask ourselves what is the purpose of this? Does it need to be adjusted? Why is it inadequate, if it is inadequate? And if it's not, leave it alone. If it is, have a discussion about what to do about it.
Tim, I can't see anyone there, so I'm not sure when it's appropriate to jump in. Fabrizio. So just let me know.
Okay,
whenever.
Okay, yeah, well, Mason is done. So, Fabrizio, it's all yours now.
Oh, great. So, I have to echo a little bit of what Andy said, and it's something that I think Mason and I have talked about offline. The people who are here talking today, for lack of a better phrase, we're kind of the in the know. We're in the weeds about 3773. We know the difference between registrars and registrants. We know that there are false WHOIS complaint requirements. We know that there is an ICANN compliance office. The unfortunate part is that the majority of people, clients, don't know, and frankly, I think most of their attorneys don't know. And I think that that's what facilitates, one, a lack of communication, two, the kind of grading letters that Elliot and Mason and those guys get, it fosters this problem, right? It just everything escalates completely out of control. There isn't any uniformity. There isn't any kind of contact person they know to go to. They just start throwing things out. When they hit a wall, they start escalating. So I think a best practice is obviously is always great. The biggest problem though is that it doesn't solve the problem, because ultimately if there isn't something that binds some sort of uniformity or some sort of process to make sure that we're having those discussions or that the things move the way they are and it's publicly known that way, we're always going to end up back at this panel, right? We're always going to have people who don't know and are sending nasty letters, who don't know who to talk to. Because I find that generally speaking, this panel included, if you sit down and talk to people, everyone usually gets to what the problem is and tends to find some sort of resolution. It might not be 100% resolution for everybody, but I think the problem is a lack of understanding of each other's issues and ultimately a lack of some sort of real streamlined process to get at those issues every time in a uniform manner. And that's what we need to get to. And my biggest fear is if we talk about best practices, Elliot Mason, their group, will go out and do the right thing, and they'll always have someone who answers the phone and does whatever. But those folks on the fringe, and there's a lot of them, won't fall into the fold of best practices. And what the effect of that is that it disadvantages everybody, from the user to the law enforcement IP protection groups to the registrars themselves, because they're having to keep up this kind of self-policing compliance situation, and yet they're still going to get stones thrown at them because they're going to be thrown in the lot of all those that don't comply with the best practice. And I guess that's the big rub here, because I think people are, in the process perspective, I think people are pushing the contract because they see that that's the only way to maybe get to the end of this constant discussion. But I do think that, as everyone stated here, if there's a way to avoid that or a way to get at, setting up a good process that everyone adheres to, I think that almost resolves a lot of the problem. And so the question is really, how do we all come to an agreement on the definitions, reasonable harm, amount of time, prompt amount of time to respond, et cetera, and then how do we set those definitions into the proper process that everyone can rely on? And once that's there, I think that a lot of the kind of hysteria, the rhetoric, people getting, annoyed with each other, dies down. Because if given a chance, and this goes back to what Andy said, and I echo it, if given a chance to pick up the phone and call Elliot's group and say, hey, guys, so I think there's a problem here, da-da-da-da-da-da, sure, what do you need me to send you? Send it, and it's over. Trust me, it's a lot better on an attorney's time. Meaning personal time that you're not wasting getting aggravated sending letters, and it's one call versus 10 letters, and it actually has results. So we don't want to be sending those letters either. So ultimately I think it comes down to cooperation, and I think a good conversation about what the real issues are here and how can we resolve them will go a long way.
Thanks, Fabricio. Bo?
Yeah, clearly, there have been some misunderstandings within the at-large about what exactly this provision means. We'll need to go back and discuss them. And in fact, I believe today, this afternoon, we have a meeting with the registrar community. So perhaps that will be a good opportunity to further figure out among the user community what this means. As far as responding to issues related to who is on this, the at-large's position on who is fairly nuanced and probably not appropriate to go into here. So we will reconvene on this provision, and probably will wind up reissuing another statement.
Thank you very much. Okay, now I'd like to open it up to a broader dialogue, and I've got Tim, Steve, anyone else that wants to join the queue? Okay. Way back. And you will have to speak into a microphone when it comes to your turn. So, all right, Tim Ruiz.
Thanks, Tim. Just putting my thoughts in the context of next steps, I guess. At the top of the list would be just to kill the advisory. I mean, I really don't see where it is going to add anything to or help the solutions that we've heard discussed today. Everything we've talked about that would solve the problems, the advisory has nothing to do with any of those things. And I think the very fact that ICANN's compliance in this regard only goes as far as making sure that that clause is in the registration agreements with between the registrars and registrants, that actually it doesn't provide guidance. It actually provides misguidance because it's advice. It's just basically legal advice from ICANN that registrars and registrants may rely on that may or may not be what the end result is if that clause comes to some sort of litigation or legal action between the two parties of the actual contract. So I think first and foremost that the advisory should be killed. And then secondly, I would second what others have said here today about, let's talk. Let's get together and try to work this out one way or another. I know there's concerns about how do we make this binding with the actual bad actors, but I think we could get there in some fashion. But we're never going to get there if we don't take that first step, and that's sitting down and talking. So that's my views. Thanks.
This is Steve Metalitz. Thank you, Tim, and your colleagues for putting together this panel, which I think has been quite useful. I really want to make a couple of points. First, just to dispose of the procedural issue that Elliot started with, I don't think there's a procedural problem here. I think the registrar's view about this advisory has been heard loud and clear. I'm not sure what the beef is there. Second, with regard to Bo's intervention, I think this provision is very unclear. It's not a very easy provision to understand, and I think it's quite plausible to people to read it as addressing something other than what we've been talking about here today. The fact is that in the 2009 version of the Registrar Accreditation Agreement, we have for the first time a reference to resellers, a very common business model, and that was hailed as a great breakthrough in the 2009 RAA, and as the chair of the drafting team that went through those 150 suggestions that Elliot and Mason have referred to, and in a team with active registrar participation, by the way, and we tried to prioritize those, but one point that came up, I believe it was from a registrar representative, is reseller is not defined in the contract. And there are divergent views about what constitutes a reseller. So one thing that's probably very important, and I think would be responsive to the ALAC concern, would be to better define reseller and spell out more clearly what the responsibilities are there. As far as next steps, I think we've heard about three of them, and I think they're all worth pursuing. First is dialogue. I am all for dialogue, and there's been lots of dialogue between the intellectual property constituency and the registrars going back many years. And if we can talk further about this and make progress, I think that would be great. Number two, an advisory. ICANN has often issued advisories interpreting the contract and trying to provide assistance to registrars and others as to what certain rather impenetrable provisions of the contract mean. So I think I wouldn't rule that out, certainly, but I think it would be better, of course, if it would reflect some greater degree of consensus. And third, we need to improve this contract. I mean, it's unclear, and the responsibilities it provides are the obligations that it spells out it doesn't spell them out. It's very unclear. They're too limited. And we have a situation now, I mean, no one has really said this, so I'll say it. The problem is you've got somebody that is clearly doing something very wrong in the way they're using a domain name. It may be something that's a civil matter like cyber squatting. It may be something that's a criminal matter. I mean, it could be malware. It could be a huge range of misconduct that's going on. And there's no way to identify who that party is or get in contact with them. 20% of all domain names are in this situation, and I agree we don't know what percentage of those are being misused, but we do have evidence that it's more common for the misusers to use these services. In any case, there's a lot of them out there, and we can't reach that person, and the registrar the proxy service, which is often the alter ego of the registrar, says, we're not going to give you that information without legal process. Give us a subpoena or a court order, and we'll get it. That's really not a viable answer, and we need to be able to do better. I think all three routes dialogue, advisories, and an improved contract could all play a role there. Thank you.
Okay, I've got a list, and I've had some hands raised since I started the list, but we've got about 15 minutes left, so I'm going to encourage people to, you know, have your comments but keep them as compact as you can. Claudio.
Hi, Claudio DeGangi. I'm a member of the intellectual property constituency, and also wanted to thank the panelists for their excellent perspectives on this issue. I mainly had a question for Pam. Last year, the IPC sent a letter to Doug Brent on 3773, and we basically outlined sort of a series of issues and some information for the compliance team in terms of some steps they could take there. So I was wondering if you had an opportunity to if you knew about that letter, if you had any thoughts about that.
I am aware of the existence of the letter. I haven't studied in detail in terms of the follow-up. I wasn't aware there was a request for us to do some follow-up, but I would have a chat with you. I will look into it and get back to you.
Okay, great. Yeah, because there were some recommendations in there for compliance, and we could also update it, because it's about a year and a half old now, and I know in particular some of the practices of the major proxy services have changed since then, so we could also update that information if that would also be helpful for you.
Okay, that would be great.
Sure.
Thank you.
John Berryhill.
Hi. I just wanted to point out that WIPO has issued numbers that indicate that about 20% of WIPO UDRP cases involve a privacy-registered domain name, which is the same ratio of privacy-registered domain names. And I think if people are going to refer to numbers or quantitative comparisons, one can cite to actual documents where people have actually studied this. I'm a little bit curious about an underlying assumption that seems to, and I realize everyone in this group is well behaved, and all the lawyers come from Lake Wobegon, where every lawyer is ethical. But you know, from the perspective of someone who sees a lot of cease and desist letters, a letter from a lawyer making a claim is not prima facie reasonable evidence of actionable harm. For example, Fabrizio's organization used to own AOL, which for, I think, a period of several months about 2 years ago was issuing threats on the basis of a pending trademark application they had for ad.com, a generic term. The Ninth Circuit told them it was generic. The USPTO, has told them on three occasions it's generic. They continue to make legal threats and maintain those legal threats against people. So what is reasonable involves, an evaluation of the merit. And as far as, getting best practices action, attorneys themselves are subject to best practices. Over the past several years, I've made four complaints about attorneys making frivolous, unfounded, or false claims to the California Bar Association. No action whatsoever. I did manage to get one attorney disciplined in Virginia. Their system works very good. But of the four attorneys that I've reported to the FBI for wire fraud, I get no action whatsoever. So, I'm curious, in a profession that does not police its own members, why the burden on evaluating what constitutes a meritorious claim falls on technical service providers. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Bo, I think you were next on my queue, and then Elliot.
I just wanted to briefly echo what Steve said, not because he pulled my rear end out of the fire necessarily, but I think we need to remind ourselves that the RIA wasn't even translated into Spanish or French until maybe 6 months ago, and wasn't in a condition that even the two working groups that McKaylee and I and Steve Metallitz and others worked on was not even in a usable format that we could that we could make any decisions on it. So I would really like to encourage staff and community to think a little bit more about how to better communicate these kinds of things so that we don't have misunderstandings of large proportions.
Thank you. Steve, I'll be more clear on the process problem that I'm referring to. This advisory was issued, admittedly, was issued at the behest of complaints or instigation from the IPC without any attempt to contact registrars about it. No two-way dialogue whatsoever. Because the advisory was issued, a lot of energy has now been sucked into the vortex of this advisory. All of that energy could have been used to solve real problems. And it gets me to, you know, to Andrew Fabrizio, it's great what you've said about going forward. And I want to reiterate that that's why I make the process comment that I do. I think that every time Two Cows or GoDaddy or other positive actors who all, you know, I never hear somebody on the IPC anymore say anything but acknowledge, hey, most of you guys are good guys, but there's some bad guys out there and they're tough to get. Every ounce of energy that gets spent with us defending ourselves, not from you guys, because you guys are good guys, we don't worry about you. It's the frivolous and vexatious stuff that John's talking about that drags us down. And that's why we have to defend so hard against things like this. Instead, I repeat, I make a call for us to work together to generate best practices, to generate uniformity and reliability, so that we're going together to ICANN compliance to stop bad practices. And I can tell you, it's better and more efficient for you guys. You get your problem solved. It's better and more efficient for us because it's expensive to engage in best practices or good practice. And it's way better and more efficient for Tim and Pam because they don't get in the middle of these little pissing contests.
Okay, we're running out of time. I have on my list right now McKaylee, James, and Christina. So we'll go in that order.
John Berryhill covered...
Please identify yourself.
Sorry, it's McKaylee Nalen. John Berryhill, I think, covered a couple of points that I would have spoken to. Dealing specifically with two things that have come up in this discussion this afternoon, I think we within the registrar community do definitely need to talk more to AILAC to make sure that there's less misunderstandings and clarify things. With respect to this particular provision, I would fall very much on the side of Wendy. As a European registrar, this provision, when the advisory was issued, I sent it over to our solicitors and he nearly melted when he considered the implications of it. Reasonable evidence. Reasonable to whom? What constitutes evidence? Actionable harm. What is it? I mean, what actionable how? What kind of harms are you talking about? The burden that this provision has in its current form is unreasonable. And from a registrar perspective, this kind of thing is just a massive headache. It would be great if we could actually get it to a point where we're able to work better together. Thanks.
This is James, and wanted to cover what John, I think, eloquently covered in reading the wrong conclusions out of some of the WHOIS studies. And not surprisingly, echo what Tim was saying, is that this advisory needs to be thrown out in its draft form and really start from scratch with a dialogue. And maybe if that's a little too radical for some folks, maybe we can use this as the beginning document for a drafting team that would include some of the folks in this room and then use it as a jumping off point. But it really needs to go nowhere in its current form. Thanks.
Thanks, James. Christina.
I have a feeling that this
Please
comment...
Please identify yourself.
Christina Rosette. I mean, I hate to point out the obvious, and that is... You know, most of y'all have agreed to this provision twice. But I do think, I agree with John. I mean, I think it absolutely needs to be clarified as to what constitutes reasonable evidence of actionable harm. And that's going to make my life easier so that when I have to write one of these letters, I'm not sending 30 copies of U.S. Register, Principal Register registrations, which I do in fact do, and 8 screenshots and WHOIS records, because frankly, that is extraordinarily time-consuming. And at the same token, I think if you have a very clearly delineated bar as to what has to be met, it makes that process of it either meets it or it doesn't, period. And as for the overzealous IP attorneys that John refers to, I mean, you know, I think it's probably safe to say that we in the IPC cringe just as much about that you all, as you all do, because it certainly doesn't make what we do any easier. And, you know, unfortunately, it's just set up in such a way that it's the state bar associations. It's not as if, you know, I can do anything about it or the IPC can do anything about it other than to educate our IP owners and lawyers for them as to what the ramifications are for some, you know, for some of these baseless allegations that we hear about.
Thank you, Christina. Is there anyone? Oh, Andrew.
Yeah, Andy Coombs. I just wanted to respond briefly on the anonymity issue because I don't think that's been sort of squarely addressed. And I think there are a couple of comments I'd like to make. The first is that many of the privacy services do, in fact, have a kind of staged response that Wendy was describing, where initially the information may not be disclosed, and if the parties can resolve it while the anonymity is in place, and that's the end of the story, that's fine. And that happens, and sometimes it works, and that can be built into the kind of process or I don't want to use the term best practices because my worst concern about best practices is the bindingness, but I think we can have some further discussion about how we can develop some binding guidelines or binding practices in this context. The second thing is, in a manner of speaking, this whole discussion really isn't about anonymity. I think despite the lack of clarity of this provision, it does contemplate that the information will be disclosed and that a person who's seeking anonymous speech on the Internet, we're only talking about it in terms of second-level domain names. There are abundant other opportunities for anonymous speech online that don't entail the registration of distinct domain names. So I think the anonymity issues that have been raised can be accommodated to some extent, but ultimately would have to succumb, essentially, to concerns about intellectual property enforcement and the enforcement of the kind of rights that are at issue. I guess I'll leave the microphone on.
Thanks. Wendy, if I could just make a brief response. I think that speakers who wish to conceal their identity for very good reasons should be permitted to have a stable location for their online speech, and that means registering a domain name so they're not dependent on a chain of others to continue to point to their location. And so I think we probably will agree to differ on the importance of anonymity to free expression and on the weighting of different elements in the balance. But while these services are available, I think they provide a valuable, the privacy services provide valuable protections to individuals trying to speak, and we should make sure that there are ways for them to continue providing those shields.
So, of course, we get to the end of our time, and we're just getting started. But in terms of looking at next steps, it does sound like there is room for some form of dialogue going forward that we may want to foster in some more, not a formal dialogue, but maybe in a more formal way where we set up some sort of opportunity for continued dialogue on this. And so we'll take that back as staff as a recommendation and look into that. In the meantime, I want to thank everyone for participating. And I think this was a lively and really informative discussion. Thanks to the panel here.
Thanks. Thank you.